It's the takeaway for Friday, January 13th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this much we know, Donald Trump is not going to be taken to prison for being a paid Russian spy. This week, anyway. It's already Friday. I'm safe with this prediction. We also know that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is not going to be named President of the United States suddenly because of a bad call by an FBI director named James Comey a week before the election.
The ruling on the field is confirmed.
Hey, it's an NFL football weekend. You're going to be hearing a lot of that, right? But back to the political footballs. A new investigation into improper manipulation or handling of information in advance of the election, the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Michael Horowitz, announced yesterday that his office will open an investigation into how the FBI handled their probe into Secretary Hillary Clinton's personal email server. Yes, we're back to that. The review will specifically look at FBI Director James Comey's controversial letters to Congress about the Clinton investigation in the weeks before the election. The investigation will also consider whether a senior DOJ official might have been a mole for the Clinton campaign. Remember, it's the economy, stupid. Remember that? Don't we have to deal with climate change? I mean, isn't there a global refugee crisis right now? A war in Syria, Yemen, and Ukraine? Hold your horses for a while, humanity. The United States has to look at some more Russian hacks and emails. Joining me now is Michael Bromwich, who served as Inspector General of the Justice Department from 1994 to 1999. He's the founder of the Bromwich Group and says it actually looks pretty bad for FBI Director Comey.
Well, the record is clear that this hasn't happened in the past. There are fairly clear requirements that the Justice Department and its personnel have observed for a very long time that you don't do things, say things, or take actions that are close in time to an election that may have the effect of influencing that election. Here you had a very odd set of circumstances where you had the Attorney General of the United States, Loretta Lynch, meet with Bill Clinton in a way that caused a firestorm of adverse publicity, suggesting that the Attorney General should not be involved in the Hillary Clinton email investigation. She chose not to recuse herself, but instead to say that she would accept the recommendation of the FBI, and therefore really saying, I'm not going to play the normal prosecutorial role. I'm simply going to accept the recommendations of the investigative agency. That put Comey in an odd position because he had to sort of explain. He felt he had to explain his rationale for doing things because the prosecutor was not playing his or her normal role. So that's what set the table for the very unusual events that happened starting in July.
What's the exposure for Comey here, do you think? You said that this is a fairly unusual set of decisions on his part.
Well, the exposure is a detailed accounting, which is what the IG's office is going to do, of exactly what he did, why he did it, and what the rules are that govern making statements of the sort that he made. So it's very unlikely that he'll be disciplined. It's extremely unlikely that he'll be forced to resign. But it will be a very public and detailed airing of exactly what went into his making the decisions that he made, both in July and then again in October and November.
Do you agree with Hillary Clinton that it cost her the election?
I don't have any way of knowing that. Certainly polls suggest that it had an impact on a lot of people.
You're a careful guy, Michael Bromwich, but we have to conclude from this whole affair that the words, I may have something else pending, is a pretty powerful weapon in the political sphere.
Oh, I think looking back at it with the wisdom of hindsight, these were ill-advised things for him to do, both in July and in October. And in November. That's certainly my view. I think that's view shared by a lot of people. Whether it swung the election or not, I can't say.
Stepping back, and, you know, I don't pay too much attention to the media, even though it's my job. I would think from the standpoint of the American people listening to this day after day about the intelligence agencies and now the FBI and James Comey, how much of a hit, credibility hit, has all of these agencies taken here in light of all this?
I think they've taken a significant hit. These agents function and earn and keep the public trust because of their reputation for honesty and fairness and balance and doing their jobs based on the facts. And both what we were talking about in terms of Comey and the FBI's intervention in the election campaign and the recent disclosures from the intelligence agencies puts a hit on that confidence and impairs it in a way that's not good for any of us.
Any advice for the president-elect how he should deal with this as he begins his administration?
Well, if you're talking about the IG investigation, he should let it go. There is really almost no precedent for any president interfering in any way with an IG investigation. Mr. Trump has said that one of his goals is to drain the swamp. Well, IGs are the personnel in government whose job it is to drain the swamp.
The swamp drainers.
Right. Exactly.
I love that. I love that. That's great.
To identify waste, fraud, and abuse. IGs are independent. There is a legal requirement that they be nonpartisan. They're the only political appointees who survive from administration to administration. And so he's best off leaving well enough alone.
So if it's absolutely unprecedented for an incoming president to mess with this, we could probably expect Donald Trump to mess with it.
Well, Ronald Reagan in 1981 fired all the IGs, and there was an absolute firestorm in response to that. He ended up rehiring most of them. So if there's anybody around Mr. Trump who lived that history or knows that history, they would advise him it's a really bad idea.
Michael Bromwich, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Michael Bromwich is founder of the Bromwich Group. He's a former Inspector General of the Justice Department from 1994 to 1999.
Those who are fighting against Castro, they should be allowed to come, like people from all over the world that are fighting their governments, you know?
It wasn't about time, you know, that's enough is enough, it's time.
They should be allowed to stay just by making it here because they're coming from a communist country and they're looking for freedom.
If they're afraid of the government over there, why a year later make some money and go back to Cuba and spend the money over there?
And if they risk their life leaving, then definitely they should be able to be free somewhere else.
Not just to come here and spend one year, one day, and then go back to Cuba with money and enjoy themselves.
Here's a story. For decades, it was a Cold War weapon dressed up as an immigration policy, and suddenly it is no more. Cubans coming to the U.S. will no longer be granted automatic residency under new rules announced yesterday by the outgoing Obama administration. Cubans will now have to stand in line at the border like people from every other nation in the world. To tell us what it means for Cuba to join the huddled masses yearning to breathe free, Tim Padgett, America's correspondent for WLRN in Miami, joins us. Tim, how special have Cubans been under the old rules?
Well, this was a policy that was set up by President Bill Clinton back in 1995, and it essentially said, as the wet foot, dry foot moniker indicates, that if you made it to dry land in the United States, you could stay. If you were intercepted at sea, you got returned to Cuba. And that was a special immigration privilege that no other group of migrants in the world anywhere enjoyed.
And it's essentially you land here, you get documents, and fast track to citizenship.
Exactly, to residency and then citizenship. Exactly. And again, a privilege that no other migrant group in the world enjoyed.
Do people in South Florida view that as a warm affection for the Cuban people or a tactic to destabilize Castro?
Well, I think they thought that it was a way to sort of drain Cuba of people who wanted to escape the regime, and that in its sense would then destabilize that very communist regime. What happened, however, was really two things. It created an incentive, at least in the eyes of critics of the policy, it created an incentive to move Cubans to take these very dangerous raft journeys across the Florida Straits, or in more recent years, to sort of be trafficked through South America and Central America up through Mexico to the U.S. border so they could get in, you know, more readily on dry land. What it also did was create a very sort of glaring image of unfairness, especially in recent years when we've seen Central Americans trying to escape horrific gang violence, for example, in their countries, or Haitians who are suffering even worse poverty in their country than Cubans do in theirs. For Cubans to just sort of be able to breeze by these other immigrant groups, it really created an international image of unfairness. And I think that was one of the other things that sort of undermined the viability of this rule.
Well, what you're alluding to, Tim, has actually cast the Cuban Americans in a light compared to others from Western Hemisphere coming to the United States in a way that will linger. I mean, this idea of unfairness, this idea of Cubans as superior or having some sort of advantage, it's affected social interactions in the United States and particularly in Florida, and that's not going to go away.
No, I mean, I one of the most vivid examples to me was about a year or so ago, you had this airlift of Cuban migrants who were sort of stranded in Costa Rica, and a lot of Central American countries who were getting inundated with Cuban immigrants coming through, they had gotten a little tired of it, and so they said the only way that Cubans could get up to the Mexican border is if the United States would airlift them. Well, they got airlifted into El Salvador, and that is a country that is probably – that has the worst homicide rate and gang violence in the hemisphere, in the world, actually, right now. And for Cubans to just sort of be airlifted into El Salvador and then ushered right up to the United States, that really left a bad taste in the mouth, not just of people in El Salvador, but across the hemisphere.
What has changed in Cuba as far as this policy is concerned in terms of individuals who might want to go back to Cuba?
Well, I think one of the sticking points, one of the reasons it took so long for the Obama administration to get to this point is that they needed an assurance. They needed to craft an agreement with Cuba that would assure that the Cubans would accept these Cuban migrants once they were turned away from the United States. There is this window now, a four-year window, in which Cubans can be returned to Cuba, and the Cuban government will accept them, reaccept them as citizens of Cuba. And I think the Obama administration is also assuming that once these residents go back, they won't be either arrested or otherwise politically harassed by the Cuban government, which had been the case in the past. And I think they were able to get, although we're still waiting to see the details, an assurance from Cuba that there would be no sort of persecution of these people once they're returned.
Whatever the details, I mean, we really should underscore this. This is a huge milestone in history from the 20th century entering the 21st century.
Oh, yes, I agree. You've had this privilege that Cubans have enjoyed. No other country, no other group of migrants has enjoyed. And I think by putting Cubans into the same category, the same treatment of migrants from any other country, I do think that it goes a long way, not just toward normalizing relations with Cuba, but normalizing our relations with the rest of Latin America, which has always resented, I think, this special rule that we've given to Cuban migrants, particularly in countries where, for example, as I was saying, in Central America, where they're escaping horrific violence. And I think this will go a long way toward improving our ties with the rest of the hemisphere, not just Cuba.
Tim Padgett is America's correspondent for WLRN in South Florida. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you.
The Department of Justice has released a highly anticipated report from an investigation into the Chicago Police Department. Findings show a pattern of Chicago police disregarding people's constitutional rights.
The Department of Justice has concluded that there is reasonable cause to believe that the Chicago Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of use of excessive force in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Our investigation found that this pattern of practice is in no small part the result of severely deficient training procedures and accountability systems.
Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced the findings of the investigation. One of the largest departments in the country has been plagued by accusations of brutality, bad relations with residents, especially minorities. A report from a city task force commissioned by Mayor Rahm Emanuel has already corroborated those complaints. Lori Lightfoot, president of the Chicago Police Board and partner at Mayor Brown, the law firm, says the entire community wants this report to be the first signal that in Chicago, the worst may be over.
Well, how can they not have despair? When we look at the neighborhoods that are most crime-plagued, we see the incredible amount of shooting and of course, homicides, coupled with the fact that the clearance rates for homicides by the police department and the detective division are abysmal. However, we have to tackle that. We have to shine a spotlight on what's not working, and we have to come up with concrete solutions. We can't afford to simply wash our hands and say it's not our problem. It's people in those neighborhoods. This is a citywide crisis, and it requires a citywide response and leadership to address it. But we owe it to the most vulnerable, youngest of those victims who are not able to stand up for themselves. We've got to do better for them.
I may be out of line with this question, but how long do you think it will take for the police to be viewed as peacemakers in the most troubled neighborhoods of Chicago as opposed to actual combatants?
Well, I think that they are viewed as peacemakers in neighborhoods all over the city. We can't paint with a broad brush and condemn the entirety of a 12,000-member force as being, you know, the armed invader. There are clearly challenges. There's no question about that. But there is progress everywhere. We just need to scale that up, and we need to build on the successes.
Of course, there's wasted lives and the violence that continues and the language that's being used about the police department, broken system, discriminating, racist in some cases. How long does it take for those scars to heal?
Well, I think that you have to do the work every single day. Every encounter with a citizen is an opportunity for change and to do better and to right the ship. And that's what really is important. The superintendent has spent a lot of time over this last year doing the right thing, going into neighborhoods, making himself available. And that is also obviously critically important. But the hard work comes way down the line with the officers on the beat when they get to the point where they recognize that better relationships with the community, more effective relationships with the community is every bit of important a tool in their toolkit as their gun and their badge. When that is something that is understood and is worked towards every single day at the street level, then we can say we've got success. But we're not there yet, but that's what our objective and goal ought to be.
Look, Lori, I know you're tough as nails, and I hear in your voice, though, a sense of optimism, and I'm kind of surprised by that. Is that what I'm hearing?
I am optimistic, and I feel like I need to be and should be. These are solvable problems. They are hard problems. They are tough. There are going to be people who are never going to buy in. But the police department remains one of the most important institutions in our city. And when I think about these problems and why I force myself at times to be optimistic when otherwise it feels very bleak is because I have a child and I think about her safety. And I think about all the other mothers across the city and particularly those mothers and fathers living in these crime-plagued neighborhoods who don't have the luxury of being able to move someplace else, turn the corner and go away, that they've got to live there and they've got to deal with the realities on the ground. For them, I must remain, and we all must remain optimistic and diligent and tough-minded to solve these problems because we need to do that for those kids. They deserve to live in a neighborhood that is safe. They deserve to live in an environment where they don't have to be taught at the earliest possible age what duck and cover is. And unfortunately, that is the reality in way too many of our neighborhoods. When I think about that, it makes me upset, but it also makes me determined to help and do what I can in my small way to help solve these problems.
Lori Lightfoot is president of the Chicago Police Board and a partner at Mayor Brown. Lori, thanks so much.
Thank you.
How's this for a headline? Cheating Fiat admits Jeeps put bleeps into the atmosphere. Yesterday, the EPA accused Fiat Chrysler of using digital software to cheat, to nullify clean emissions technology under certain conditions, allegedly enabling more than 100,000 diesel vehicles to emit illegal pollutant levels. The EPA's assistant administrator called this a clear and serious violation of the Clean Air Act, and the news comes just a day after the Department of Justice indicted six Volkswagen executives for their role in an even more severe emissions cheating scandal by that company. John Stoll is global auto editor for the Wall Street Journal in Detroit and says despite both being rooted in software, the Fiat and Volkswagen cases are significantly different.
This is a sin of omission. You didn't tell us that the software was on the car. You need to disclose that. Now, I think there's a lot more that needs to be brought to light here in terms of whether or not this was, you know, deliberately deceiving regulators, whether this was an omission, a bit, you know, poorly done paperwork or what have you. Sergio Marchionne, the CEO of Chrysler yesterday, was very combative, wanted to make it very clear to the media that he believes there are no parallels between what happened with Volkswagen and what's going on with Chrysler. They have a difference of opinion with the EPA. He blamed the politics of the situation. This is a late administration move. Guys who are headed out the door trying to clean up whatever was outstanding, and that's their viewpoint. My experience has been the EPA is not in the business of pointing fingers before they have a lot of evidence. So there's more that's going to come out in this, obviously.
You know this better than anyone. With the proliferation of all this technology on the emission side of the vehicle and on the engine control side of the vehicle, has it become for engineers and designers a bit of a gray area when you're dealing with emissions that they don't quite understand what they're able to do or permitted to do, or is this a clear violation?
I think that we've seen since Volkswagen emerged 16 months ago in this scandal, 15, 16 months ago, that there is a lot of gray area in terms of how emissions are tested versus how they operate in the real world. It seems that every automaker is using emissions control software to regulate, manipulate, and that's not in the legal sense, but to manipulate the way the car operates under different conditions so that it is either getting optimum fuel economy, optimum emissions performance, or optimum horsepower. This was definitely true of what was going on with Volkswagen. I mean, they wanted to advertise the car with certain attributes and meet regulatory requirements at the same time, and they couldn't do it without cheating. Now, you know, to take that and say across the board that every automaker that's employing sophisticated software is cheating was a stretch too far. And obviously, you know, this is an investigation that's been going on for quite some time. These cars have been on sale. The Fiat Chrysler has been selling for several years, and this is not something they woke up to yesterday. So it does take a lot of investigation. And I think diesel technology is particularly problematic because if it's not treated, it can be extraordinarily dirty technology.
So software problem, does that mean it just takes a simple zip drive to fix? Is this a recall that we're looking at?
I'm not 100% sure how this one would be fixed. The Volkswagen fixes were so enormously complicated, and the layman and even the car enthusiast might not understand it. In this case, it does seem like there is a software situation that you would think could be either remotely or handled at the dealer fix. But again, some of this remains to be seen, and this is going to take some disclosure on the part of Fiat Chrysler, what exactly is going on, and if something indeed does need to be fixed. They are not selling 2017 versions of these vehicles, so obviously there's something underway to remedy the situation. Mm.
And no indication of what the conceivable environmental impact would be, has been, that sort of thing?
No, not at the moment, no. Again, something that was very explicit with the Volkswagen situation was a blow-by-blow scenario of how much was being emitted, and in this case, we're not seeing quite that disclosure.
So do consumers have to be all upset about their adorable little Fiats now?
Well, we're talking about Jeep SUVs and Dodge Rams,
right,
where diesel technology has been used for several years in the heavier vehicle applications. I don't sense that there's going to be a lot of folks waking up today as concerned. Maybe the Volkswagen thing sparked so much outrage. And again, the allegations are softer here. And whether or not there needs to be a lot of concern is something that remains to be seen. But there does need to be another look here at the intersection between regulators and what automakers are saying to the public about the performance, whether it's on the gasoline side or on the diesel side. To take your thumb off that at any point in time is probably a bad idea.
John Stoll, Global Auto Editor for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much, John.
Thanks, John.
Is there finally the political will to shut down once and for all the aging and increasingly insecure Indian Point nuclear power plant located north of New York City along the Hudson River? Governor Andrew Cuomo has continuously vowed to put an end to that facility, located 30 miles outside of New York City, and this week he took it one step closer by striking an agreement with Entergy, the owner of the plant, to shut down both reactors at Indian Point by 2021. I sat down with Paul Gallet, president of Riverkeeper, the watchdog organization that defends the Hudson River. They were involved in this agreement.
You've got my number. Will you call me the moment you're done that you know you're out of there completely?
We were also joined by actor and environmentalist Alec Baldwin, who generally needs little prompting to talk politics. When he's not acting, he's organizing, and yesterday he was organizing an office move on his mobile phone, in addition to expressing his worry that the energy picture is changing, and activists have to keep up.
I believe that all of this is driven by an economics that didn't exist until fracking came into play, and cheap natural gas and oil. I mean, many people in this country don't realize that fracking is an oil exploration as well. And you're only having this because they can't make this pay anymore. Nuclear has become too expensive. Building new plants, and there are a couple plants that are online that are going to be built, I think, is it in South Carolina? They're going to come online with
Georgia, South Carolina.
Right, there's a couple. But I'd be hard-pressed to see if they finish those or the ones that are finished if they really, really go online, because it's too expensive to power things with nuclear power anymore.
So everyone agrees. The plant's going away. The decommissioning is beginning. There's an agreement about that. Okay, so there's a new administration coming in. It sounds like no one's going to reverse this.
Of course, it's far be it for me to imagine what they're thinking. But a large company says it's a business decision for them, and they seem to respect business decisions from companies. And this is a matter of state interest and state permitting as well as federal permitting. And Riverkeeper had a stake at the table on the relicensing. And so there's no reason to overturn this because there's no tension among the parties. The only tension is finding the right jobs for the people who work at the plant and making sure the local municipalities are made whole for the changes in their tax base when this thing closes.
People listening might think, okay, Riverkeepers, they hate any nuclear plant. There's no nuclear plant on the planet that they would ever support, even though nuclear power is renewable and doesn't put carbon into the atmosphere. What do you say to that?
Well, that's a lie that has dogged the work that Riverkeeper has done. And that is this idea that these nuclear fuel rods come off the nuclear fuel rod tree somewhere in some orchard somewhere, when in truth that the mining of uranium and the fabrication of that into nuclear fuel rods is a very carbon-intensive process and a very dirty process.
Inherently, this technology is unsafe and not viable economically. That's your view?
This is old technology. Plenty of people will tell you that new technology is available for new nukes, yet it's not ready to come to market. They are well over their time frame and their cost overruns. The beauty is, you know, you can like nukes or hate nukes. You know Indian Point is too old and dangerous. There aren't 20 people who don't work for the plant or for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who understand the facts, who think this place is safe. But what you don't necessarily know is all the opportunities for well-paying jobs on energy efficiency, on solar energy, wind, all the ways we can replace this plant and end up carbon neutral or carbon lower. Without this plant, this plant's been holding us back for sustainable energy supply in the New York metro area. There's no two ways about it.
Finally, since you're a student of pop culture, what era does it evoke?
This technology, when I think about it, reminds me of the 60s and when Kennedy tried to leverage the nuclear test ban. We always set aside Ernest Sternglass and people who did the baby tooth study and how the daughter element of yttrium, got into the teeth of children when they were born, and they studied those teeth. And when after the ban it went down, and then when Nixon decided he wanted to ramp up nuclear reactors, it went back up again. The nuclear process was developed to make bombs. And then they said, well, let's just run some steam pipes through there, and we're going to make a business out of this. And that turned out to be a mistake. It's a very expensive mistake. It's been a very costly mistake in terms of public health and safety. But now is the beginning of us turning back and undoing that mistake.
Alec, Paul, thank you so much.
My pleasure, John.
Paul Gallet is president of Riverkeeper, a member-supported watchdog organization that defends the Hudson River. Alec Baldwin is an actor and longtime supporter of Riverkeeper and host of WNYC's Here's the Thing. We'll find out from Alec Baldwin on Monday what it's like to channel Donald Trump in a lively conversation we'll play for you next week.
Do you remember very much?
The boy. Is he dead too?
Who?
The boy, Jason.
I'm going to give it to you straight about Jason. Still out there, some sort of demented creature.
It's Jason Voorhees.
Jason, Mother is talking to you.
I never really chopped wood before.
Fridays, and that means movies. Raver Guzman is here, film critic for Newsday. Slim pickings this weekend.
Yeah, pretty slim pickings. We only got two movies. The third one, Sleepless with Jamie Foxx, they're not even showing for critics. So I can't tell you about that one. You tell me, John.
Yeah.
I'm going to say a lack of faith there.
Lack of faith there. Well, lack of faith would seem to be the theme of this week's offerings, I would say. Movie number one, surprised it hasn't already been made, Monster Trucks.
I press the gas, throttle wire, pulls these levers, which open these blinders. Right?
It's like the truck's a wheelchair for it.
No. It is an engine for my truck.
It's a monster truck with a monster inside and
You got it. You got it, John. Exactly. You know how snotty critics like myself are always saying things like, a four-year-old could have come up with this movie. In this case, a four-year-old actually did. The son of the former Paramount Pictures president came up with the idea for this movie. Didn't write the script, obviously. But this movie has taken a lot of heat. Paramount reportedly took a $150 million write-down on the film before its release, anticipating, essentially, how badly it would do.
It doesn't benefit from the Sharknado effect?
Apparently not. I think, in fairness, I would say I think this film wanted to be a sort of Transformers blockbuster tentpole. It's not. It really feels like kind of a cheap, made-for-video kind of movie. I think if you were to take your kids to a matinee just to keep them quiet for 90 minutes, you might figure that was money well spent,
but
it's not going
to
pull you over.
Agree. Monster trucks are irresistible in our culture.
They are irresistible. My 9-year-old loved the film.
Oh, really? Oh, well,
what can I tell you? He's no critic, though.
Yeah. Bye Bye Man. That's a horror film. And is this legitimate horror?
It is. I know you're thinking January release, but this is a legitimate horror film.
There's something happening.
He's found us.
Who?
Don't think it. Don't say it. The Bye-Bye Man.
And the more you think about him, the closer he gets.
Really? The Bye-Bye Man?
That's right. Now you've said it, John. Now it's going to come for you. You thought
like
it and you said it.
Or something.
It's a pretty simple premise here. You've got this kind of demon slash monster figure. If you think about him or if you say his name aloud, he will come for you. And if you know it, if you speak it to someone else, he will come to that person too.
So, and the soundtrack is what conveys this telepathy. Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a pretty, I would say, low budget movie that doesn't have a lot of money for too much elaborate special effects and sound and such. But I think it does pretty well with what
really?
It's got. I think it's got some clever moments where the kids in this film start to hallucinate things. They think, one friend is becoming an enemy. They mistake each other for the other person, and you know, mayhem ensues. I think it's pretty cleverly done. There's some little surprises here and there, a little humor, which I always appreciate. I can't say it's the next coming of Rosemary's Baby, but it's kind of fun.
Well, in the CGI era, I do think that stripped down, sort of primitive brainstem horror movies can be great. I love that Babadook movie.
The Babadook.
It was so, very low budget, but fantastic.
Yeah, a great movie directed by a woman, as is this one, which I think is kind of interesting.
Interesting.
Not something you see in the horror genre very much. So, I can't give it a full-throated recommendation, but I think if you're a horror fan, you'll kind of appreciate the lack of special effects, the lack of gore, and more the concentration on sort of dread and tension and scares, which I thought was fun.
Just pure primitive emotion.
That's right, John.
Bye bye, Rafer. Our
bye bye
man, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
You too.
The emergence of the transgender rights movement came quickly over the past 8 years when it finally came. Some signs in the form of the successful TV show Transparent. Caitlyn Jenner's very public transition was a radical step into the light, as was the case of WikiLeaks defendant Bradley Manning, who became Chelsea Manning. But in Colorado in 2013, these issues were raised in an elementary school.
It is a violation of the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act to deny a transgender person access to the restroom that matches who they are.
6-year-old Coy Mathis became the emblem in the fight for transgender rights. Standing on the steps of the Colorado State Capitol, the Mathis family put themselves front and center in the fight to allow Coy, who identifies as a girl, to use the girls' bathroom in school. Their case became one of the first in the U.S. to specifically address transgender bathroom rights. The film Growing Up Coy tracks the difficult-to-imagine risks taken by Coy and her family.
I'm not going to Girl Scouts Tuesday.
When Coy was little, everything was girly. She liked to wear dresses. She liked to dress up.
When she started asking us, when are we going to get the doctors to cut her penis off? That was when it became a problem, and, we reassured her that we would do everything we could so that she would be happy as an adult.
Eric Jehola and Jeremy Stolberg began filming the family 6 weeks before they went public with their fight.
When we met her, Coy was 6 years old, and it was over time that Coy's parents started to realize that this wasn't just a phase. This wasn't something that Coy was going to grow out of. They started allowing her to present herself as female, which is how she was identifying. And when she was able to present herself as a little girl, she was much more happy, much more able to participate at school. Whereas when she was forced to go to school as a boy, it was temper tantrums. She didn't want to get out of bed, go to school, things like that.
The other interesting facet of it is the fact that Coy is actually a triplet, and she has a triplet brother who presents as the gender that he was born as. And so it was an interesting sort of litmus test for them.
How did former Marine Jeremy deal with his own assumptions about what it meant to be a parent, what it meant to be a parent of a son, what it meant to be a parent of a daughter?
By the time that we got there, he was very much on board with Coy presenting as a girl, and he had made peace with it. But he talked about, very poignantly, about the struggle that he went through to get to the point where he was able to do mm-hmm. that. But he talked about, and this is what makes him an extraordinary parent and somebody who's, I think, emblematic of a new generation coming up, is that he saw that this was something that was very important for his daughter and that it was important for her well-being, and he embraced that.
But both of these parents collide with the idea that I think is common to all parents. If you do blank, the other kids in school are going to blank. And this was the mother load of that. They were going to create huge ripples in their own community. How do you tell that story?
Both parents were very worried about how Coy would do at school. But they had a conversation with her teacher. This was in kindergarten, the year before we started filming. They had a conversation with the principal. And everyone at that time agreed that it would be okay for Coy to come to school presenting herself as female. So they made the transition over the winter break. And, you know, the thing is, when kids are 5, 6 years old, it's not
a big deal.
It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Kids just want to be kids. Mm. The teacher said, Coy's a girl, and everything was fine. And it wasn't until a year later that the principal called Coy's parents into the office and said, actually, we've had a change of policy. We would like Coy to use either the male bathroom or the nurse's bathroom. Jeremy and Catherine said that that would really be like putting a scarlet letter on her that tells everyone that she's transgender and really setting her up for harassment and bullying. And it really is, you know, a separate but equal policy. So they decided that they were not okay with that, that they wanted Coy to be able to use the little girl's room just like any other little girl. And that's what set this fight into motion.
When you have a civil rights issue, somebody has to be on the front line. And this family was on the front line. And that was what our film became about.
In a sense, it's easy to be on the side of a heroic little child who's taking risks that she doesn't even really understand and will only understand by looking at your film. But nevertheless, how were you challenged here in terms of your point of view as journalists, as filmmakers?
We really had to think hard about how are we going to tell this story about a six-year-old. So we decided early on we would not ask Coy direct questions about her gender identity or anything that might put her on the spot.
You guys show such restraint. No direct questions. What is it in your heart that you would love to say to this little child?
Well, I'm actually fascinated to see how Coy will see the film as she grows older. And in a couple of years, after she goes on hormone blockers and goes into adolescence and becomes an adult, I'm curious to know, you know, what this period in her life will mean to her. Her parents, I mean, I think that their mentality from the beginning was that they were trying to make her life better in the future. She, in many ways, was, you know, on the forefront, and she was this sacrificial lamb, and, you know, for the transgender rights movement and for all transgender people to be able to use bathrooms associated with how they identify. So, you know, I'm curious to see how she feels about all this 10 years from now. That's my curiosity.
But just to add to that, you know, this case, when it was decided, you know, they won the case in Colorado, but it did have and continues to have ripple effects around the country. Shortly after that case, California enacted a law that protected its transgender students on one side, and then you have states like North Carolina, Texas, and others who are going the other direction. And of course, we have the Supreme Court case lined up right now, coming up in March or April, about a student in Virginia who is transgender, about bathrooms. And so, you know, this case set a precedent that's affected so many people around the country, making lives better for transgender people.
What would you say if you could, if you say something right now?
Being able to use the bathroom at 6 years old, it's one victory, but there are many more challenges in store for Coy and all transgender kids as they get older. You know, transgender students are more apt to be bullied, harassed. There's a higher suicide rate for transgender teenagers than the rest of the general population. So I would just tell Coy to stay strong. And if she can be as strong moving forward as she was at 6 years old, she's going to be in a good place. And she's got parents who love her very much, and that counts for a lot.
Eric and Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eric Jehola and Jeremy Stolberg on their film Growing Up Coy. The first gay president. When Newsweek called Barack Obama that back in 2012, you could say they were looking to stir things up and grab a headline, as well as commenting on an unexpected national trend that the president found himself in the middle of. By the end of his term, Barack Obama will have seen legal rights for gays and transgender people affirmed in a number of state and federal and Supreme Court cases, as well as in statewide ballot measures. In addition, there was the repeal of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and most recently, his defense of transgender people in response to the so-called bathroom bill in North Carolina. We asked Heather Kronk for an assessment of Barack Obama's leadership in this major shift in American culture. She was the co-director of Get Equal, a national LGBTQ organizing network. She had three words for it.
Well-intended and reluctant. What we saw over and over again throughout President Obama's tenure was certainly an interest in moving LGBTQ equality forward, but a real reluctance to spend political capital on doing so.
So you think he took no risks? He just followed along a transformation that would have taken place anyway?
I think that's right. I call it equality inflation. He was matching the speed at which the country was moving, which I think he said multiple times on the record that he didn't want to get ahead of the country. That was actually something that we needed him to do, that we still need for him to do, and that we need other politicians to do, especially in the incoming age of Trump.
Is there any value, in your view, in him finally agreeing after his period of reluctance to champion the rights of LGBTQ community members, as he has done since the Supreme Court ruled?
Yeah, I think that it's been important. I mean, it's been important for folks like, you know, my mom and dad who live in Kentucky to hear the President of the United States publicly embracing LGBTQ people, right? That's an important public stand to take. The fact is, though, that he did that, you know, a little bit too late, where he moved his administration to take executive action rather than taking, you know, really spending political capital to take legislative action. And what we're seeing now is a real fear within the community that President-elect Trump is going to come in and dismantle much of what President Obama was able to do, because he did most of that behind the scenes and most of it within an administrative capacity rather than moving legislation, which is much more permanent.
Is there a track record in these kinds of issues of developing that sort of legislative consensus? I mean, I recall the fiasco of Don't Ask, Don't Tell during President Clinton's first term, and he lost a defense secretary and you know, came out big on that and was sent packing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's certainly risk on the part of a president whenever he or she takes big action, takes big, bold action. We saw that with the Affordable Care Act as well. President Obama spent a lot of political capital to get the Affordable Care Act through Congress, and did so while the Democrats still had a majority in the Senate, in the House and the Senate. But after spending that political capital, the Tea Party takeover really limited his ability to spend political capital on other things. And rather than taking big, bold action and building up political capital that he could spend, he went underground a little bit. And we didn't see as much big, bold action from him on LGBTQ equality, on gun control, on immigration, on many of the other things that we really needed to see a progressive president embrace.
Do you think that marriage equality is the capstone of the president's human rights record?
I think it's one of them. I think that it's the one that has certainly gotten a lot of attention from folks on the right. And, you know, I think that if the president had done more around immigration and moving forward comprehensive immigration reform, that might have already, you know, kind of matched marriage equality around what he was able to get done. But I do think that it was probably the thing that had so much public support that folks on the right found it really threatening and used that to characterize the president's agenda.
But how are you worried then that it would be rolled back under the next 4 years, given, as you say, there is so much support publicly for recognizing a certain kind of equality here?
Marriage equality is the law of the land given a Supreme Court case, and so that is more permanent. Nothing is ever permanent, but that is more permanent than other pieces of what the president has moved through his administration. There are other things that are kind of underneath marriage equality, that are to the side of marriage equality, that have moved over the past 8 years that are, you know, much more fragile. The housing discrimination protections housing equality protections are on the chopping block. Equal access to education is on the chopping block. Even, you know, equal access to credit is on the chopping block. None of these are legislative fixes. And so even, you know, if folks in same-sex relationships are able to marry legally, the quality of that life is on the chopping block. How we're able to move, how we're able to create families, how we're able to, move through our lives will be characterized by what happens over the next 4 years of a Trump administration.
So you worry that without explicit guarantees and safeguards for equality in all of those domains that you've specified, that it will be easy in communities that believe that marriage equality is wrong to discriminate. And whatever the law is, it will be tolerated.
Absolutely. There are still no federal legislative workplace protections for LGBTQ folks. You know, even the most basic things, it's so unbelievable that things like that, simple, common sense things like that are not in place, that, you know, there are some state provisions in place around workplace protections, but there's nothing in the legislative field. There's nothing at the federal level. And so given the Trump administration's stated antipathy for queer and trans folks, and given the aggression that we're seeing from folks who he's putting into his cabinet or seeking to put into his cabinet, I have no conclusion to draw other than the next 4 years are going to be pretty painful.
Donald Trump certainly made a lot of political hay and got a lot of success from telling it like it is and being very straightforward and direct regarding a lot of controversial positions that he took. Do you think that in hindsight, Barack Obama's, you know, lack of that sort of direct and forthright, you know, set of principles regarding anti-discrimination for members of the LGBTQ community meant that he was, number one, cowardly, and number two, missed an opportunity to basically show himself as being a leader?
I do think that President Obama missed an opportunity. I wish that he had been more forthright, because I think that I have a pretty good sense of where his heart falls, where his head falls, but we didn't hear exactly the same thing via his words. Donald Trump established a reputation for telling it like it is, but for telling a very, very small slice of the truth, and the truth, I think, also being generous. Donald Trump got credit for telling it like it is from the perspective of someone who embraces white supremacy, misogyny, and xenophobia. And that's not what I wish for a U.S. president. I wish for a U.S. president to tell the truth, but to tell the truth from a perspective of someone who embraces everyone, who does not malign immigrants, who does not malign Muslims, who does not make fun of folks who are disabled or differently abled. So if I had to choose between a measured President Obama or a reckless President Trump, I'll pick a measured President Obama every day.
But why is it the case in America, and maybe this is a clearer way of asking the question, why is it the case that Democrats presume that they will be punished for taking forthright positions on LGBTQ rights, and there's no such fear of reprisals politically for taking the controversial positions that Donald Trump takes in quite the opposite direction?
Yeah, because the Democratic Party is cowardly, because the Democratic Party as an entity plays not to lose instead of playing to win. And, you know, I'm hopeful that of all of the terrible things that I anticipate coming out of a Trump administration, that one of the positive things that, and I hesitate to couch this as positive, but one of the potentially positive things that could come out of a Trump administration is the Democratic Party growing a spine, growing a backbone. I know the left is going to challenge the Democratic Party to do so. And if they can't do that inside of or underneath a Trump administration, then I don't know what use the Democratic Party is anymore.
Who would lead in that case? Is it Barack Obama, who seems to be the most senior Democrat right now, or is it a Bernie Sanders? Who is it?
We'll see what comes of the DNC chair election that's coming up shortly in February, I believe. I think that a lot of Bernie Sanders' rhetoric was great, but the fact that he could not, for the life of him, move away from an economic message to talk about a racial justice message, I think was a real liability, and will be a real liability in talking about the future of the Democratic Party. So I hope that the voice or the voices that emerge inside the Democratic Party are ones that take seriously that white folks need to talk about race, white folks need to talk about immigration, white folks need to talk about countering misogyny in all of its forms, countering xenophobia in all of its forms. And I'm still looking for that voice inside the Democratic Party.
Those are positions and issues that are very much in play in the American conversation right now. I guess I'm really struck and possibly shocked that Heather Cronk, you don't see leaders in the Democratic Party right now who are going to pick up those issues and run with them.
I see the beginnings of that, but I'm still waiting for the people who are going to play to win and to play to win using that message. You know, what we saw in the 2016 campaign cycle was that the loudest white voices talking about race were white supremacists, were white nationalists. Were folks who want to move a xenophobic set of policies forward. And so, you know, we need white folks inside the Democratic Party to aggressively talk about racial justice, and we need folks of color inside the Democratic Party to step into those leadership roles and insist that we are going to take up the mantle of the Democratic Party, because so many of the talkers inside the party have really failed to move those messages forward.
Heather Cronk, thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
My name is Terry, and I'm calling from Oklahoma. I've served 26 years in the military under the fear of being discovered as homosexual. President Obama's repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the making of marriage equality the law of the land, that is something that I can't even begin to express my gratitude and appreciation for. Recognition as a full member of the military and a citizen of this country that I love so much, that is immeasurable.
We'd love to know what part of President Obama's legacy most directly affects your life. We've been hearing from a lot of you, for good or bad. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment on our Facebook page and have a great weekend. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.